The recording is in progress. The speaking is in progress. It is the new spanking new brand new version of the podcast. It's now Rhetoric Training for America. We have moved off the hardcore warrior, rhetoric warrior metaphor, and we're going to move over to a little more neutral training. But that doesn't change the goal, which is to get some of this rhetoric ideology, this rhetoric approach, this rhetoric technology shoved out into the world and see if people will actually use it.
You're just laying down the sword.
Yes, I'm laying down the sword. I'm coming in with a olive branch instead of a sword. So I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, all the stuff. And again, today we're talking to Dr. Dave Payne, emeritus. And today we're going to talk about purpose, the function of purpose, telos, trajectory, motive, all these word of clouds around it. What are you trying to do when you walk into a situation and you want to be rhetorical? So that's what we're doing. And you launched, earlier in the week about the Taylor Swift stuff going on right now. We're about a week and a half away from the Super Bowl. And so, like, seeing all that stuff kind of thrown up into the universe and the MAGA coming in on it, and then sort of people like going, what? You know, so what is the purpose of, like the NFL's using Taylor Swift for their purposes. Taylor Swift using the NFL for her purposes. MAGA is trying to drag them over into their purposes. So it's a war of purpose.
Well, and then there's the added, because this could be influential, it must be purposive. So there is the effect back to cause reasoning that, you know, that so this must be the deep state. Once again, you get back to your ultimate causes for whatever effects you observe. And that then leads you into a kind of an ethical universe. Well, gee, this just isn't right. There's something in error here. Because Taylor Swift is on the dark side of forces, rather than just, you know, rooting for a boyfriend. So,
Well, you know, this is one of the things that people, when they first hear about rhetoric and hear that you're a rhetorician and move you instantly over into manipulator, it's this idea of what is your purpose for doing formal technique in messaging? Like, it must be some ulterior and ergo villainous purpose.
Right. I think the whole kind of naivete about rhetoric, that rhetoric is a bad thing because it indicates, it comes with its sanctionable purposes. It comes with it, you know, so the fact that you are intentionally trying to persuade somehow makes it, you know, as though there's a world of other kinds of, you know, innocent talk that does not try to persuade, right? So I think automatically, that's how, you know, built into the idea of rhetoric as a pejorative term or label for a kind of speech that is itself deceptive and intends to, you know, is this idea that there's somehow an ulterior purpose here. And that there's ways of talking and being in the world that don't contain that. So I think that's, you know, that gets back to it, is that, in some of the more naive, you've probably had this experience with students where you'll show, here's how this, you know, here's the rationale for this advertisement. And this seems perfectly obvious to you. And they go, wow, I never thought about this from that point of view, that these things were put there with this one goal, right, to affect your perception or whatever. So that, I guess, once again, there are people who walk around in the world not understanding that, you know, most of the things that you see there are put there for a reason. These messages are crafted. So along with that becomes this automatic suspicion.
Right. Somebody back there that I don't know and that I'm not currently seeing had a purpose and purposefully and designed this message to accomplish that purpose with me.
It's like the whole flap over subliminal advertising, for instance. Mm-hmm. The word subliminal really doesn't, refer to any particular set of practices. It just means below the threshold of awareness, which, right, the lemon is itself an artificial construct, that this is just the level at which you're aware of something. So the fact that it was done, but you weren't aware of it, automatically makes it subliminal, right? But that becomes the kind of mystified as this evil lurking subconscious thing, or the idea of the subconscious itself. Subconscious motivations are themselves of that character, right?
Yeah, I had the thought this morning. I was like, I don't know who is authoring the script on my dreams. I mean, clearly, you know, it's my subconscious, but I'm not in charge of that. And it's a pervert. Like, whoever it is, there's a pervert writing my dreams. So, like, where's this coming from? Like, I clearly wouldn't have I wouldn't have done this. I wouldn't have written this.
Well, okay.
But I mean, you know, that's the fact that you are not, that your subconscious is writing scripts that you probably wouldn't write yourself. Always gets tied back in psychoanalysis and stuff of, oh, you would, you're just not aware of the fact that you would have written that. It's doing it a more authentic authorship for you. And I'm like, really? This giraffe and my third grade teacher riding around? Like, really? I don't know.
Well, not to wax too deconstructive, but just the just the framework that these are authored is itself a kind of an intentionality to it, that there is an author with motives and purposes doing this. Once again, leading to your own ethical judgment about whatever that is going on inside your head, a pervert, right? Whereas I think, you know, at least one legitimate description of how this happens is your brain just tosses crap out, and then there is some other sense-making function that's kind of organizing it. And what seems to be these elaborate, you know, narratives are really about, you know, 45 tenths of a second, sorts of flashes or something, right?
So, right.
But I know exactly what you mean, right? Where does that come from? That doesn't seem to be me. You know, who am I in this dream? Who's
right? So do I move my authorship, my, you know, my real self over into that and say, oh, that's who I really am? Or do I, like, hey, you know, get this author out of my head because it doesn't feel like me at all?
Well, and let's make a note of that just sort of in the parking lot or the margins of the conversation when talking about purpose, is that probably that whole subject of agency is relevant here, right? And back to Taylor Swift, since these things are actually having impact, there must be agency. And if there's agency, there must be an agent. And what kind of agent is needed to produce this kind of cataclysmic effect, right? Ultimately, you get back to, you know, or I guess on the pushing back to the ultimates, you get to, oh, it must be the deep state that's really moving the Super Bowl, moving the football teams, moving, right? And if you start, I guess my joke that I texted at you know, with my brothers who are Chiefs fan at that point is, since Taylor Swift is rigging the Super Bowl on behalf of Biden, if you get those kinds of causal sequences out of order, that it becomes quite absurd. But in a way, that's what's being implied.
Sure.
Right. The Super Bowl is fixed because otherwise, how, you know, why would she even be there?
Well, maybe that's the place to start as far as a technical, useful, mechanical view of rhetoric, which is what everybody always seems to want to get to. They want me to give them the tactics, right? Theory, yes, it's great. And I love wandering around theory here, but they always want me dragging back to tactics. I'm like, okay, well, one tactic might be then to do an agency excavation trail. So let's take this message and then draw back the agency trail of where it came from. What are the sources? Because it gets back to something that I developed for information work, which is this kind of mega down to pico categories of information. And the mega agency is always like, it goes, you know, all the way back to God and the supernatural, you know, or power groups, hidden power groups. So the elite, you know, conspiracies, human nature, you know, things like that. So biology, those are our sort of mega agents that we're always kind of, it's like that, you know, these huge transformer mega entities that are fighting for control of purpose and agency and cause.
Sure, you can't avoid the basic hermeneutics of good and evil that interlace with those once you are dealing at that level of abstraction and force, right? Yeah. So you these entities all have purpose.
Right. And so God transcends
a particular historical moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like that's one of the things I was talking about when I do guests on podcasts, conservative podcasts or liberal podcasts, where you're trying to clean up the structure of their thought a little bit, you know, try to give it a little more formality so you can find the flaws in it. But I'm like, let's just go back to if God is the prime mover and now Taylor Swift is in the Super Bowl, what's the trail of agents between those two things?
Well, and that, yeah, and I'll try to stay out of the theoretical clouds a little bit, but
no, it's fine. I'm just saying that's what people always want.
Once again, that becomes a mode of interpretation, and it has a particular, you know, it is the backward reasoning from from Taylor Swift back to the prime mover. So when looking backward to how we arrived at this moment, you can pick and choose among historical events. So it is that picking and choosing of the relevant factors, and this gets back to tactics. How do you change the conversation? How do you turn this from, right, a story about love and celebrity and you know, a song of innocence, right, where these are two, you know, loving cultural icons just enjoy being human beings and we're enjoying being around it. To some dark, sinister. So you know what then that interpretive bent. And it seems to me that the reconstruction of the past in rhetoric is always of that character. We pick and choose those past events to historicize the kinds of motives, right? I was thinking in terms of you know, a kind of an obvious sense of this overarching sense of purpose, or what you call telos. And just something like Martin Luther King's, the arc of history bends towards justice, right? Okay. So that is a future looking idealistic that somehow the kinds of sufferings that we engage in today, the battles that we fight today, are taking us to this kind of outcome. But if you turn that same kind of arcing backward, that same kind of reasoning, right, to pick and choose the counter narrative, right, to how did we arrive at today's injustice, then we pick and choose different kinds of events on a different kind of timeline. So that is tactic, right? We do interpretation. In fact, that's kind of one thing that rhetoric ultimately must be, is it is a communal reading of these events and these signs and how that might be steered, right? And it is steered by picking and choosing those kinds of interpretive themes and arcs and patterns with which the audience is familiar or psychologically disposed to adopt.
Right.
And one can do that, you know, as a matter of how do we feel good about our company and coming to work and, you know, the kinds of things that we do, being part of a good timeline that going to result in great stuff for us and the world, that, you know, or if one wants trying to do the let's name and cast out evil on the part of bad actors, you would choose a very different set of historical constructions.
Well, I think it's really interesting when you look at this idea of like an agency timeline of something like here, are all the different agents that had to act to get us to this moment. And wherever you chop it off, wherever you lop off the timeline and say, that's the cause, the original agent that I want to deal with right now. And you do this sort of quick rhetorical work of kind of valence work of positive or negative. Like, is this a villain or is this a hero? And you see these very, you know, fast mega assignments of those things. When you can locate an agent, you're like, okay, Taylor Swift has some kind of agency in this. She's choosing to go to the Super Bowl, right? So is she positive or negative? you know, and how do I amplify the negative if that's my choice for her? How do I amplify the positive? I've seen a lot of stuff on social media of especially women grabbing the Taylor Swift side of the narrative and be like, yeah, you know, she's shoving abortion rights and all these other things into your face by getting airtime and getting more popular with the NFL MAGA types and then doing messaging around these social issues. You know, so that's that kind of very conscious rhetorical construction that she's going through because she has the opportunity to do it. And then you go, is that accurate agency? Is that, you know, a myth? What where are we at in that sort of assigning the agency ecology, I guess, you know?
Well, there are all these opportunities and frames that one could post. So one glance here, and it becomes this sort of cacophony or, you know, cauldron of people doing these kinds of interpretations. That's just sort of the media environment in which we live, right? And some of it can get very entertaining. So some of the criticism of this particular move and what it says about the people who are making it, I find pretty entertaining too. That's another sort of vocabulary of motivations, right? Why are these misogyny? Why are these people upset with Taylor Smith or Taylor Swift? Right? But so one little framework, you know, that you just sketched out is, well, you know, Taylor Swift is a human being. She has great celebrity, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing. She's certainly not the first celebrity to think, gee, I can advance certain causes for good here, right? But then one little reporting that one might get off of Fox News or whatever is Joe Biden's trying to get Taylor Swift's endorsement. So Joe Biden becomes the evil agent trying to, and this ain't right. Why that would be, I don't know. right? Why that would somehow be out of the norm of even if true. But once again, if Taylor Swift has the kinds of purposes that you say she does, it's going to be logical that she's going to support the Democrat regardless of, right, whether it's Biden or somebody else, right?
Well, it's very interesting to watch people. You know, there's the pro agency yourself, the source is trying to be its own agent. And then there's the counter narrative for the agent where Biden is behind all of this. Like, they've done a lot of this. And this is one of the reasons why I think people are like, oh, Biden's behind the polls. I'm like, well, this is the first time Biden's been in the public eye being attacked for his agency, you know, consistently by national sources for years on end. You know, he hasn't been around. They weren't taking tons of shots at him when he was vice president, you know, but now that he's been president for 4 years, he's absorbed a lot of dark arrows that are assigning him agency just, you know, on villainous fiction. Like, he's the mob boss behind all of this. And you're like, just that dark agency, you know,
dark Brandon. Yeah. Well, yeah, Biden didn't get all the heat because we had Obama, right? And Obama was getting all the heat. And before that, it was Hillary. And before, you know, So that is part of the game here, I guess. But and once again, there's all these sort of stock commonplace tropes that are available and out there. Which one of the public candidates or figures has not been featured as Hitler? Going back how far? I mean, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I've argued we need a new dictator. For some reason, Stalin never got to the, you know, we need to broaden our hall of villains for the narrative a little bit. It's like, I'm getting tired of seeing Hitler.
I think it's interesting as to why he will continue to be the gold standard. Right.
But yeah, I mean, you can't use Pol Pot. You can't use, you know, Genghis Khan. I see people every once in a while throw stuff like very historical villains, and everybody's like, I don't even know what that is. You know, I guess Hitler's still got enough recency that he has some, you know, vibrancy in his villainy.
So, I think it's culture, and I think it may be rhetorical. If you get back to, what just the rhetoric of nationalism itself. Right. And its strategies. I mean, it is a template that, hey, we're, you know, In other words, make America great again was certainly not new to Trump. Certainly Reagan and Nixon before, right?
Well, it's in the 1800s.
But if you get back to make Germany great again, I mean, so it is itself, you know, one of those templates. And one then has to really start looking for, well, let's look at what one is doing with that. Not the words themselves are not, you know, the agency. They're simply vehicles for a rhetorical mindset to focus our attention one way or another way. So
if you look at sort of rhetoric as a set of tools and this kind of ecology of tools that we can pull out, and we go to purpose and agency, and you start to see it's a very contentious space, assigning agency and denying agency. Like Trump now has to deny a lot of agency with, you know, his trials. It's like, oh, I didn't do that. Like, he's very good at like grabbing agency for all the powerful things that he never did. You know, like saying, I healed the COVID. Like, I solved that. And you're like, hey, you weren't eight. That's not you at all.
He ended Roe v. Wade. Yeah, he ended Roe. Yeah. He ended Roe. Yeah.
And he just plays that game of just sort of like checkers, just grabbing agency, trying to shed agency. Like, I was not trying to author a, you know, insurrection. That was not my intent. I was just trying to make sure that, you know, we have free and fair elections. You know, so he's like constantly playing that agency game, it seems.
There are some examples here where this is why his depositions and his testimony is such a legally precarious thing, is because he doesn't want to claim, right, his narcissist tendencies. So I guess his depositions when you know, yeah, of course I did that. That's, you know, I am running things. Whereas the more legally strategic thing would be like, oh, I didn't know that was going on. You know, that's just, you know, I'm just the company head. Other people are taking care of that. No, he wants to pull that agency to himself to say, yeah, well, of course I approved those documents. Of course I read that. But yeah, probably he didn't. But so in a way, he isn't playing that game as skillfully as his lawyers would like for him to do that.
Oh, I don't think he plays stuff very skillfully. He just grabs everything, you know, and right, if it starts to hurt a little bit, he tries to get away from it. If it does good stuff for him, he doubles down. You know, sure. That's why everybody's like, Trump genius. I'm like, no, Trump is just good at reading the room, like the reaction of the room.
But you allude to this a minute ago when, you know, you were talking about Biden becoming the target, and you know, whoever's in that seat will become the target. And that's part of the strategic. But what that does is it perpetuates this idea that the president is, you know, the leader. It is part of the way we can rhetorically construct the leader, right? As this person who has those potentials, those powers, when indeed, you know, so we, and part of that is because we also want to be able to blame the person who's in charge, right? And so I think we have a very, very unrealistic and counterproductive idea about what the person and their character and their and once again their innate motivation. So I think in terms of you know, rhetoric and leadership and organizations, that's a humanistic kind of anthropological consideration that's incredibly relevant. We tend to make these attributions, and we can count on people making these sorts of attributions. So yes, hero villain is part of the drama that they're in.
Well, and the fact that we need, as human beings, we're trained to find the cause, find the agency, find the history that, and even like in healing, and I've worked over the years with a lot of people who essentially are public gurus and have a healing modality, whatever it is, and they have to trace it, your problem back to something very specific so that they become the right prescription to it.
Sure.
So it's like, oh, you are this way because, you know, like in psychoanalysis, because your childhood, you know, that's the agency, your experience back then, and therefore I know how to deal with that. And if that gets disrupted at all, because I've run into this a lot where I talk to people about, because I used to be married to a therapist, and so it comes up from time to time. And I'm like, yeah, therapy has this set of explanations. Rhetoricians don't really care what your set of explanations are. They're just going to take it apart. You know, that's the whole game to me. It's like, oh, I see the tools you're using, the tactics, the techniques. I'm like, I'm just going to take it apart and look at it a little bit, which drives people crazy if they've already accepted an agency trail as the trail, as a very valid way of looking at human beings. And if you pull something out and go, so I was talking to Zeke, my son, because he's got free therapy with his job. So he's been, you know, going to therapy. And he'll pull something up from the past. He's like, well, we were raised like this, ergo. I'm like, yeah, but I was there when you were being raised like that. I remember some nuance across the spectrum that you don't. You know, there's different agency here, and they were raised in two different homes. So they're raised in my home, and then they're raised in their mom's home. And I'm like, well, where did the trajectory come from? Was it me? Was it her that led you to this point?
So well, that's the personal variation on what I was saying before about the reconstruction of the past, right? Under the auspices of producing a certain effect or a certain explanation, right? So we pick and choose those events. So once possessed with a theory of self, mm-hmm. or problem, we pick and choose those events that best, right, lead to the conclusion that so they become causal. So yeah. That's what you know, talk therapy is the reconstruction of one's past under the auspices of, right, a theory of motivation. Yeah. I actually wrote about this, you might recall, right?
I do remember that. He wrote quite a bit about that.
Had this thought, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Talk about that a little more for people, because I think, again, I tend to be a cut and dried person when I do rhetoric about it. I just want to see kind of grids. So when I see, like, here's what you're saying is happening right now, and here's your implicit cause, even if you haven't thought about it, like when I was on this conservative podcast last week, he's an evangelical Christian. So he tied a ton back to Christianity and Jesus and God. And I kept going, okay, like he wanted to tie rationality, Western rationality, back to Christianity. He's like, Christianity came up with that. I'm like, the Greeks were kind of talking about that before Jesus showed up, but he didn't want to go all the way back there. He was like, no, the Christians are the one that took it and developed it and made it a real thing for Western rationality. And I'm like, well, that's a perfectly valid claim. Now let's see if it's true. You know, you can make that claim. Now let's sort of go back and see if that agency is correct. I think you've lopped off a lot.
That's when you leave the surly bounds of Earth, right? That's when you leave real history and go, even if historically, you know, rationality was in Western rationality, a la the Greeks, from Plato to Aristotle, all pre-Christ, right? But then of course, what happens with, you know, in Christianity? Augustine, Thomas, right on down, is that they were reading Plato and Aristotle. Right. So there is a relationship there.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point. It's like, well, it gets embedded.
But once again, sure. And this is why, you know, our often cited Fred Burks is, anytime you're in this domain of human purpose as a motivation, it's laced with mysticism. We can believe that entire historical development was somehow incipiently the purpose of the Christian motive, because the Christian motive preexisted Christ, right? So and of course you get into these giant tautologies, you know. The Father already had the Son in mind when, right? Okay.
The unmoved mover is a hard argument.
From effect to cause, right? So. That purpose was sort of out there from the beginning to arrive at this moment. And so, yeah, I mean, this person associate that timeline, just sort of lining up the goods, and who are the agents in that story? from that person's particular interpretive universe. And just to say that, you know, once again, when we're looking for agents and agencies, every ideology comes complete. You know, the Marxist knows who the bad guys, who the good guys, and bad guys are, right? And we continue to point those out. So the game of politics really is just that kind of, you know, fantasy football with your teams of good guys and bad guys.
Yeah, and I love getting that
to wreck it with a metaphor. Yeah.
No, but if you can get that into people's heads, that these are just pieces on your chessboard. So both sides have their characters.
Of course you're saying that. Yes.
You know, and you're just trying to move your queen, your god, or your king, queen, because they had all the power, into the right, you know, and everybody else is like, no, your queen can't do that. Your god can't do that. Like, it doesn't have that power.
Right. Well, yeah, we would like to get people playing with some set of rules here about what is and what is not a logical thing to do, to claim about who does what. So, yeah, the NSA somehow being in cahoots with the NFL and Taylor Swift to result in a Biden victory. You know, please, this is spinning your wheels. But
that's okay to me. It's like, I don't mind flawed agency reasoning. Like, it's fun to talk about. Maybe it's because of my comedic roots, but to hear something that's so wildly fictional and you're like, who did what? Like, if you watch the interviews at Trump rallies and MAGA events where they freeze them in logic, and they're like, well, if Antifa was trying to stop, you know, the vote from being certified, but Biden is their candidate, why would they want to stop the vote? And people are like, because they can't.
Why are we putting them in jail if they were Antifa?
Right, but they can't take that agency, that agent, and match it up with the purpose.
Right. Well, this is we noted ahead of time that somehow this will shade off into conspiratorial. You know, the dysfunctions of conspiratorial, because these are self-enclosed universes. And so I think one of the hallmarks of that is that entertaining these multiple but mutually exclusive narratives of cause, right? And so once again, the picking and choosing of, well, that doesn't, you know, the Antifa theory of the insurrection not only admits that it was an insurrection, but assigns, you know, the cause, does not square with, you know, oh, gee, it wasn't an insurrection at all, and these were patriots. You know, so how is it that these people are able to entertain both sets of, or really what are three or four different sets of completely contradictory interpretive frameworks at one time is really kind of the hard thing to understand. Yeah. And I think what that just means is there's kind of a lack of rootedness in any one particular point of view.
Well, and the other thing is, you think about January 6th kind of as a metaphor for rhetoric in general, you know, there's a couple thousand people milling around and fighting and everything else in those. But look at all the agency. Look at all the agents. You know, was this false flag? Was this the DOJ? Was this MAGA? Was this Proud Boys? Was this Trump? And it's like this big orgy of possible agents that were actually making this happen. You know, and that's been the argument, you know, sort of dissolution ever since about, well, find me the one that actually did this. And everybody's like, it's Trump. You know, he's the tentpole mover, sure. Tentpole agency.
But any movement has the capability of bringing in many of these sort of layered, you know, causes and people with purposes together, right? So in a way, you could say yes to all of those. The Proud Boys were there, as far as I could tell, right? It seemed to me we had camera footage that they were there. Trump really was there, and really did have a sense of, you know, that some of these people were there for him. Although I think, once again, phenomenologically, if you start peeling back the layers, he was there for them. They were there using him and this occasion for their purposes. And that's what we never really talk about when we get into the leader, you know, is the source and cause of all things, right? that we never talk about all the people that are using Trump for their ends.
Right.
And I think you know, in terms of the deconstructive or the interpretive part of rhetoric here, we need more sense of that, right? Who are all the actors on this stage? Because that's where things really get done. So anyway, that's part of the game of history, is which explanation emerges victorious. And that's also the game of changing that historical narrative to match whatever purposes one has. It's back to George Orwell: he who controls the past controls the future. Remember, in 1984, in the 1940s, technology of media there, they called up and they rewrote the newspapers every day to fit whatever narrative they wanted of that day. Well, we don't have to do that because nobody has a media memory longer than 72 hours anyway. And once again, Trump has profited from that lack of memory. Basically, we just redefine it every news cycle. And that really is, kind of the brilliance of the moment, or just even, contemporary propaganda.
So then is the ultimate cause, the ultimate agent, historical forces? Like, when you start breaking it down that, like, okay, you have individuals who can be the agent, like a leader or Trump, the horde itself, the mass, the mob, but the ideology, is that, or is it the historical forces, this kind of unsentient wave of history moving forward that's causing all this? Because everybody also is still throwing this back to where you're getting this kind of weird conspiracy sounding, but not actual conspiracy, it's reality. Like, is Russia authoring all of this?
Sure, that's out there, because Putin benefits, and therefore he can become part of the play. Yeah.
Well, and nobody weaponized unethical rhetorical practices better than, Russia and, the inheritors basically of Hitler, right? I mean, they took a lot of those same techniques and like, well, we can use these not in war too. Let's see what happens.
Well, yeah, there is, I think we're becoming more and more aware of just the dictator playbook, right? But sure.
But that, so is it, if we're trying to say like, oh, Trump's not really even the prime mover here, it's modernity and the dissolution of, the media and the simulacrum and these kind of big forces. He's surfing it, but he's not causing it.
Accident design, coming together at any particular moment, I guess, is the only way I can answer your metaphysical quandary here. When you say, is it this or is it that? Well, I mean, ultimately, those are all possible interpretive frameworks, right? I actually have somewhere in my unpublished notes, right? A chart of, breaking down what are the possible movers here in terms of a rhetorical point of view. So yes, historical forces. And, once again, that kind of biblical God and history are big ultimate movers. If you're a Marxist, it's history. Dialectical materialism. If you're right religious, it's God. But I think the point is that our vocabulary of motives, our bigger schemes of purpose and outcome that our little ones kind of hop on board of, those that are familiar to audiences and our narratives kind of lean into or evoke as rational, as legitimate. And that depends on the orientation of your audience and their cultural and rhetorical history. So yeah, there are this kind of vocabulary of ultimates.
Which I'm the same way. Like, I love a good radiograph of, so here's the event and here are all the potential causes that you can pluck up, as rhetorical chess pieces. So if you're like, yeah, well, God, this is what God wanted all along, which is that's a very difficult, hard one to logically dismiss. But then you get to the situations where even God breaks down as a agent of cause. You know, so like when you look at the universe, you're like, okay, it's how many trillion billion galaxies and stars, and
well,
this
that's
is
why
the
that's
only
why God people don't want to go there. Okay,
right, sure. And this is the only one that's got life on it. Tell me why the original agent would have, what purpose that could possibly have. Like, it's too stretchy.
Well, and I guess once again, there are the sort of the purposeless interpretations out there, right? That this is just all a set of
chaos, random chaos as a prime mover. That's competitive with God, right?
Oh yeah. Although once again, even the sort of scientific explanation, curious to me, there are these kinds of purpose-driven forms of reasoning. So sociobiology is fascinating to me in this regard, and evolutionary theory in general. Having observed this kind of effect that the organism developed this kind of trait, they will then engage in this kind of ratiocination of, well, that's because it was trying to adapt for survival, right? That's sort of the big one. So it produced this effect because so you invent the kind of the motives, even though they are not conscious motives, that the organism must have had to evolve in this fashion. Otherwise, it wouldn't have this particular characteristic if it didn't enable it to survive somehow or another. So you can get into these same kinds of thought chains, and of course argue about them, right? Or change them. But that's still going on. So even the theory of evolution has a purposiveness to it.
Yeah, I mean, human beings have a hard time with a driverless car, you know, like there's no cause here at all. Like, this sure just happened. Like, it's, yeah, that's a tough thought pattern.
Although there are, you know, it seems to me that Zen, although I wouldn't claim it's, a super successful, it's kind of a reparative therapy of sorts, does sort of contemplate the possibility of purposelessness as sort of its own objective, as a way of kind of combating these dysfunctional senses of purpose that drive us into bad motivations. So it's not unheard of. Yeah.
Yeah, I think especially it as a antidote to too many purposes or the wrong purposes. Get rid of purpose, you know.
Sure. Sure. Or the purpose is simply this purpose is simply be.
Which is a purpose. So you're not really.
We don't need to find some other rationale behind it. Yeah.
Become a non-agent.
Well, that would be, yeah, right.
So abdicate your agency.
And that's, of course, probably a Western cliche misunderstanding. I wouldn't claim to be a great authority on Zen, but I think that it does lean in that direction against this kind of surfeit of purposes that seem to confound us in our interpretive world.
Well, it is an odd thing logically to say that, you know, your higher purpose is to get rid of purpose. And the most agency, the thing that you're really born to do is to become unborn and unagented and unpurposed, you know, to dissolve, which is again, sort of a logical oddity.
Well, I don't know whether this is at all helpful, but you know, it used to be if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. This was kind of the old mantra, and over time, I've come to more feeling, well, if I'm not part of the problem, I am part of the solution. So I think that is the countervailing point of view. Just take myself out of the problem, I'm creating problem sustaining part of that discourse. And that will be at least a step in the direction of a solution. So I think knowing the difference between those would probably be helpful as a critical toolkit.
So how have you negotiated agency, like personally? Like, how, again, I always try to ratchet this stuff back to the personal. When you think of agency, what your purpose is and what your life purposes have been, have you chosen those? Have you looked from the options and grabbed them and said, this is the ones I want to pursue, or did they just happen to you? Like, I see this a lot with people, and Zeke right now, he's 21, trying to figure out his next step. So he's had a good job. He's halfway or third of the way through college. He's like, well, there's where do I go? Like, what am I? Am I an artist? Am I a technician? Like, he's searching for agency so that he can choose. And he has a hard time making choices because he doesn't feel like a strong agent. He has too many options. And I know with me, like, my agency, born in working class Kentucky, was clear from the start. It was to get away from working class Kentucky, you know?
That was a purpose. That wasn't the agency. You adopted the agencies that were available to you with that purpose in mind.
Right. I became an agent.
That's why education was a route for you, the same way that professional sports might be for somebody of a different socioeconomic background, or or government service for another, whatever.
Right. So I took on the agency in order to accomplish that purpose.
Well, that would make sense. We're no means to an end. Yeah.
But is that how agency happens then? We're not born with agency. We pick and choose from the agency possibles based on desire or anathema towards our.
Yeah, I don't think we're probably, you know, I mean, I think if we would, that we may as biological organisms be born with a certain amount of agency. We can move matter, right? Whatever. But where that goes from there, depends on historical accident and design. And so I think I'm too much of an existentialist to ask the question. When you say about what Zach's doing, is he searching for agency or is he searching for identity? I would think he's searching to have an identity that then anchors this agency somehow or another. I want to be a technician or I want to be an artist. When, you know, almost any artist looking back at how they got there would have to say, it was both technology and, you know, creativity, you know, those things must work together. I think agency is exactly that merger. So as an artist, his technology, skills will be his agency. Same way if he were a great painter or, you know, musician or some other. But at the time he's worried about identity. Who am I? Right. As kind of this hypothetical platform. And as an existentialist, you know, I think maybe that's the wrong question to ask. Just do. Right.
Right. And I think that's what he's done. He's now having just done, he's kind of like, I'm not unhappy where I'm at, but I want more of a super happiness. I want the trajectory that fits me. I want to become the
well. Yeah, that quest for happiness is one of the pitfalls of the purpose world, right? That's one of those overriding purposes, which is the most elusive. Sure.
Yeah, and you see
the pursuit of happiness.
And you see a lot of the guru types who are like, that's basically what they're doing. Is like, I know what you're after. You're not happy enough now, or you're even unhappy. Here's the trajectory you should follow, and that will remake you into the agent, or I will remake you into the agent that will follow that trajectory. You know, and then you see people falling off all the time, like, well, I'm doing this, but I'm not getting this. So I accepted the agency, but it's not actually getting me the outcome that I want.
Yeah. Well, having spent my entire life working with young people who are in the same sort of self-gestating mode, and they may come to school education with all these purposes, ideas about what they want to do, but ultimately they fashion themselves as a brand, as an identity, however you want to talk about it, around the opportunities that come to them and sort of the identity marketplace that's out there. So we all make our peace with that. We all make our compromises there. So you may be beset with these, but then these opportunities to do stuff. And once again, then the reflexive quality of that is you become the person who did that. So you have to incorporate that. So I can say, I don't think I was born with the purpose of fighting ignorance and educating people and making the world safe for ideas. those all became little banners along the way as I found it possible to get through graduate school and make a living and feed myself while avoiding factory work and right.
So then do you look back and reinterpret your agency then? Like, I mean, identities here and agency and then, you know, where you ended up. I think like when you're older like this and you look back, okay, and you're like, okay, did I end up here because of my chosen agency, because of my agency, or because of circumstance, you know, things like
I think there's a little Donald Trump in all of us in the sense that we all want to claim to have impacted things that we didn't choose. You know, I want that see Pursuit of Happiness and Therapy.
A little Donald Trump in all of us.
That discussion, right? We all reconstruct the past under the auspices of some favorable interpretation of events, right? So we will all try to account for success and failure when constructing these kinds of narratives. Sure.
So we overclaim our agency when it works to our
and we overclaim our failure, right? Because failure is all bound up with agency. If you didn't have any power to control things, you didn't fail. So to fail at something is to automatically adopt an interpretation of these events where I could have influenced things, or I had influence. I could control my fate. So it is itself attempting. It is part of the construction of success and failure are themselves bound together in that interpretive world. And it is all about agency. Sure.
Well, and this is again one of the big wars I've experienced with personal agency versus sort of cultural agency. Or even going back to like linguistic agency, that you're kind of pre-programmed to a certain life when you accept a certain set of language and a certain culture. And it does a lot of agency for you. It's going to take care of an awful lot of which you did not really choose. It's just unconsciously kind of running your machine. And, you know, I think that's one of the things first attracted me to rhetoric. And even
exactly,
it's like, oh, I can interrupt more of this.
Well, rhetorical training is itself to increase your vocabulary, to increase the kinds of language that you can inhabit. And those are linguistic agencies. So from the teachings of the sophists in Greece, that was exactly, that's exactly what they were marketing. Say, here, you can be a different person. You can succeed at court. You can win in the law courts. You can influence people, right? How to win friends and influence people. So that's what sophistry is all about. So as a rhetorician, and you're saying here, I want to do rhetorical training, it is to precisely to gain control and sophistication with employing rhetorical strategies that will transcend one's class, as you pointed out about your own, and I pointed out about my own background, to provide social mobility. And that's what education is about, is it not? At least what state education is about, the people who paid me, what rhetorical training is about. Here, if you can successfully pull off these performances, and it is what leadership is about. You can have more power to influence people if you are able to do these kinds of things. So yeah, that's exactly what we've been talking about at the practical level.
Yeah, and I'm still doing it. I'm basically a sophist that I'm selling, rhetorical tactics and training to mostly business people, but also in politics and sort of personal efficacy in the world. And it is the sense of I'm competing with other self-help. I mean, rhetoric at some point becomes a set of tools. Like you said, you can do your own identity work on yourself. You can see yourself as having more ability in situations to affect those situations. And you have a set of tools. I mean, it's literally this set of, like I see people trying to use the fallacies in argument now, like hitting somebody with, oh, that's a straw man. And I'm like, you feel like you just dropped a bomb on them, right? Like you just put them in a straitjacket because you labeled their fallacious reasoning. And now you expect them to give up that sword and they won't be fighting with that one anymore. They just keep fighting with it. It doesn't really matter whether you've labeled or not. But it is the set of, that kind of equipment for living, right? The Burkean, stories. Rhetoric is the same thing. It's equipment for living.
Well, I think so. And I, once again, not to continue to wax philosophical, but I think in the bigger picture, and I sense this in your mission with the work that you're doing, being fainted by these kinds of tropes and metaphors and narratives that we seem like we've got to work and sacrifice and let blood on behalf of to prove their truth on the planet, that these fated, the tragic outcomes here, the apocalyptic scenarios, those are self-fulfilling prophecies, right? Those rob us of agency. We must work on behalf of this outcome because the final answer is all. And I think that kind of mood is dominating the conversation right now. It's dominating politics. Is this sense of doomedness? Despite all the evidence, 71% of Republicans today think the economy is terrible. It has nothing to do with how much money they have in the bank and whether their children are hired or whether they got promoted. It is because of this narrative that somehow this is all headed in the wrong kind of place. And so the facts are bent to support that outcome. So how do you once again, the rhetorical challenge is, how do you open that up to reinterpretation? Facts don't seem to be working very well because, and what we have been talking about is, how does one then live in these kinds of interpretive bubbles where the conclusions are already known from the assumptions that we make? We're finding it shockingly difficult to do. And part of that has to do with the media environments in which we find ourselves, the kind of selectivity over media, the weakening of institutions, but also, the kind of the prevailing force of these dominant narratives. And the people who, gain power and advantage as a result of repeating them over and over and over again. So I think there is this kind of bigger picture here that the rhetorical point of view, the sophist point of view that you're talking about, where we can adopt, we can adapt, we can strategize and change things, is itself a humanistically positive, framework.
Yeah, they keep asking me.
You got to get a group consensus that that's where we're
right. At. Well, and that's part of it too. I think when I appear on the conservative podcast, they always end up asking me, well, what are my politics? And they ask me, am I religious? Because I'm being analytical, I clearly am a liberal. And I'm like, well, let me avoid those labels for a moment if I can. And I'm like, here are the things, like I sort of built a list of, I have an acronym for it, but it's about 12 things that I tend to believe in and I tend to vote on. Like I tell them, I vote for the funniest candidate because I'm a comedian, the person who's going to be best to comedy. Not that they're able to make fun of the best, but like they set the right environment, whatever. But and they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, that is a criteria that you can do your politics on. Who's the best with jokes? Who's the funniest guy? Who's the most, comedic? And I'm like, Trump is just too much drama for me. Like, he's too much hardcore conflict. He just roils everybody up and he ruins comedy. You can't relax in comedy clubs anymore because everybody's so, dysregulated and outraged that they're.
Well, I mean, it is all my battle, right? My struggle.
Yeah. And so I'm like, that he's bad for comedy. So I'll never vote for Trump.
Well. He does not introduce a lot of comic points of view.
Yeah.
He does fund many comics, but
some of the meta voids, they don't know how to react to that because they haven't been told how to react to that. But sure. Like when I use humanism, so that's one of my pinpoints. I'm like, well, I'm a humanist. I'm not religious anymore, but I do believe that you should basically try to treat everybody pretty well. That seems like the best policy to me, And humanism, man, it's been a while. I remember they just the right went after humanism, I think in the 70s, pretty hardcore.
Secular humanism became the modern school. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's been out of the
godless evolution of its own, right?
It's been out of the headlines for a little while, but it's been brought back. And so he had some pre-built attacks ready for humanism. I'm like, I don't think you understand. Let's go back and let's see if we can define what humanism is. because it underlies all your Christianity, at least, like, you know, the real Christianity about, you know, treat others as you want to be treated. That's pretty humanist. And he's like, you know, they don't like the, like when you, again, sort of let's pull the strands out of the rhetoric and say, you know, instead of just making humanism a demonistic term.
Yeah, well, what Jesus is for these days is up for grabs here.
He's been,
I read it sort of the same as you. You sort of thought, well, hey, look, guys, we've already got a vengeful God. What we really need is to care for each other and make it a good planet to live on. Yeah.
Jesus has been through some things lately.
Jesus has been through some revisions lately, absolutely.
Well, I had the thought last week, too, about, like, the only two human beings I know that changed their, tried to change their, that had their skin color changed was Michael Jackson and Jesus.
That's funny. Yeah, I think you're, once again, there is no comedy in politics for that particular group of people. And once again, you know, even all the various, the 50 shades of gray to that are contemporary conservatism, which I think to me are not all in classic, consistent with classic conservatism. They all have the point of view that we are looking backward and the fall has happened. We are falling backward. All right, it is the lament for the past, for the lost past. Things were better once, and now we're falling away from that grace.
Right.
I think that is the fundamental clause. So that's a tragic point of view. And the only thing you can do then is kind of rescue yourself and get on the right side of this stuff because it's coming down. And yeah. I hear that echo, that drum over and over and over and over again. And if you start, you know, once again, start sampling as I do, it's my job, right? These kinds of discourse. It all begins with something has collapsed, something has failed, right? And so those rhetorics are dominated by a presumption of failure. This is, everything has failed, and how do we set it right again? Well, that's a pretty hard, you know, there's something very tempting about that reflex. And people come to that with a sense of failure. People come to it with a sense that something has gone wrong, and how, you know, what can I get on board of to either save myself or, right, live with this, right?
It's a tough one.
The comic impulse is directly an opposite of that.
Right. The comic impulse, things are fine. Let's have fun. You know, I'm curious as to your reaction because there's two things that are sort of allied rhetorics. Like I remember, I guess it was in my master's degree, I got interested in the rhetoric of corruption and pollution, which came back up, you know, in the last few weeks or months of the campaign with Trump saying they are poisoning the blood of America, you know, which is a very hardcore propaganda, you know, anti-immigrant, subgroup rhetoric. And they just lifted it directly out. So they lifted that one, you know, basically unedited out of the propaganda tool book. And then this week, Tom Cotton talking to the head of TikTok, whatever, I guess it was TikTok, who's from Singapore, and asked him, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party of China? Like the exact words of McCarthy. And I'm like, how do you lift these
even
things
a
out?
Drop of that sort of blood, even if you were 15 years old, right? Yeah.
How do you drop that? How do you resurrect that stuff that easily and drop it into modern day discourse? I guess it is the rhetoric of forgetting. Like you have to remind.
Well, it's part of the, you know, it is a religious structure. It is the guilt, redemption, purification cycle. It begins with a sense of corruption or pollution. Right. Something is tainted. Something is wrong in our midst, or is something out in the world. And then how do we see that it is corrupting us?
Well, the something becomes
there's evil in the world, right? And it's corrupting our in our own midst.
Or you have to have an agent in that cycle. You have to have an agent. Right. So you have to assign an agent that caused this if you're going to do anything with it politically.
Sure. No. Yeah. This is not just, you know, gee, stuff happens. There is typically because you can't battle it, you can't you can't cast it out unless you give it agency, right?
Mm-hmm.
Agenthood. So it must be some, that this is why we construct these evil forces that are causing this to happen. The naming of the problem is the first rhetorical step. This is how you know, once again, and you want ultimates. This is why the international Jewish conspiracy is hanging out there as,
right.
as kind of the fail-safe moment when your conspiracy theory goes global. But there is this, you know, vocabulary of evil along the way. Little evils get piled up into that one big evil or whatever.
Yeah.
And so we become aware of problem, become aware of pollution. Our corruption. That pollution is seen as a corrupting influence in our midst. Then we give it a name because we can't cast it out. We can't purify ourselves of it until we name it. And then when we start recognizing it around us, then we know. So once again, that's how Taylor Swift becomes an agent of evil. That's how. She's just like a nice girl to me. Right? Pretty innocent, if not particularly interesting to me dancing with. However, it is because she lined up with these forces of evil. And it just is like that Chinese checkers, right? The marble just starts falling from Super Bowl to, you know, Biden, to she registered voters to liberal causes to, oh, gee, now she's an agent of the, the deep state. The forces that have taken possession. So this is basically the religious cycle, interpretive cycle, whereby we can be motivated and gathered together to cast out evil from our midst, and achieve our own personal purification as a result. There is that redemption or rebirth that we get from having cleared ourselves of that, right?
Right. We took out the agent of evil.
Huh?
We took out the agent of evil, so now we can be pure. Yeah.
Well, and it, you know, it's like the old revival tent. You do this on a yearly basis when they come through town, right? This doesn't last because the world. You know, I grew up with a kid who would go to the revival tent with his family and then come home and break all of his rock and roll records, and then in the subsequent year he would rebuy them.
Right.
By the time April rolls around, he's smoking cigarettes and cussing and listening to rock and roll music again, drinking a beer. But then he would go to the revival tent and all of a sudden have to renew the impulse.
Yeah, because if there's one thing we know is that the devil has better music.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Across the board.
Well, it's music. It's music that can make you wiggle your butt in certain kinds of ways. Yeah.
Well, cool, man. Again, you know, I always enjoy these. I want to, you know, just sort of keep bouncing around on these different topics because to me, sort of, again, I get drawn into the world of business and sort of people trying to find actionable information. They just want to use it right now, which is nice because like with when you teach in college, it's, oh, you're going to use this in the future. And they sort of lose it in that abstraction. So they at least have concrete purposes. But it's always fun to come back and just wander the whole field of rhetoric, you know, oh, here's a big hornet's nest of theory, you know, here's some practical technique. So it's always fun.
Well, they all hook up at some level, right? I mean, the tactics and strategies are there because they do this kind of work. And, that doesn't mean, you know, I don't know what kind of mastermind, I don't think most of the practitioners or even the masterminds who sort of have intentionality behind all of this. But we are all swept up into these kinds of interpretive tide pools and eddies, and they exist as structures for, they're just imperfect evolutions of the means of human cooperation. How else do you make society and get people to move and work in one kind of direction? So organizations have to be, and nations are all using these same kind of shared templates. Those shared templates just go back in time to tribal society where, you know, people weren't all that smart. And they're shared because it doesn't require being all that smart.
Right.
They get repeated over and over and over again. So, anyway, for what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, come hang out here. We'll make you smarter than your tribe. All right. We'll do the modern tribe.
For a period of time.
Yeah. Not happier, but maybe smarter. Well, again, thanks. Super fun. This has been Rhetoric Training for America. Get out there, persuade people. Don't shy away from it. Train yourself a little bit so maybe you can be more effective with it, and come back and see us again in the next episode.